Welcome to all of you. Thank you so much for being here tonight. We welcome you to the work meeting, the study meeting for the city of South Jordan. This is our city council work meeting on Tuesday, February 4th, 2025. My name is Dawn Ramsey. I have the privilege of serving as mayor of the city of South Jordan with our outstanding city council seated here with me and our administrative staff. We appreciate all of you. We have members of the planning commission here, members of the public here. We welcome all of you. Any joining us in person or electronically, we welcome you. We're going to open the meeting tonight with an invocation by Councilmember Jason McGuire.
Our dear kind Heavenly Father, we are grateful to be able to come together and meet this evening. We are grateful for this land of freedom in which we live and pray that thy hand will continue to watch over this land. We pray for thy guidance that we may be able to be respectful and civilized towards one another as we discuss the issues this night. We pray for thy guidance that we may be able to do what's best for the city of South Jordan. And these things we pray in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you. All right, mayor and council coordination. Anybody have anything you'd like to bring up? There is a lot going on at the legislative session. There's a lot happening at the Capitol. But anything else outside of that? Anything else here local that you want to talk about besides what we have formally scheduled?
I'll be assuming there's not a dark horse candidate. I'll be elected the chair of the Jordan River Commission on Thursday.
Awesome. So. That's
congratulations.
Awesome.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Okay. Congratulations and thank you for your time there.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah.
Look forward to find out about the dark horse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great.
It's, I think it's a good group. It's been interesting to be in the midst of people who are for real tree huggers, you know, but.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not the side deal, but that's their main hustle.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's
there's
good.
No kidding about that.
Well,
but
they will be lucky to have your leadership, and we appreciate your leadership there. Thank you. That's awesome. Anyone else? No? Okay.
Is there items you want to talk about with the, about the legislature? Or when do you want
there,
to do that?
Mr. Luce has a few things I think that he's going to potentially bring up in the staff.
I can bring them up now.
Legislative.
This is easy.
Maybe, but let's probably wait till the next meeting just because we have a lot on this agenda and not on the next agenda, if that's okay. We'll still get
whenever
out.
Whenever you want.
Okay, that would be great. Yeah, there's a lot going on, and there's a lot in flux right now that we're just going to wait and see. And by way of note, I head back to Washington, D.C. Sunday with the Wasatch Front Regional Council to attend the National Association of Regional Councils, represent Utah there in our regional council with the folks that do the same transportation planning for their states. So I have that conference this week, and I'll be Wednesday meeting with all of the delegation again. So that's always a good opportunity. We'll be talking transportation priorities specifically.
You'll be meeting with the Utah delegation.
Our Utah delegation on Wednesday.
Great.
Yeah, with each of them. So.
And you're retained as the president.
Yeah, I might mention this in my minutes or in my notes, but yes.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Thursday a week ago, the full Wasatch Front Regional Council met and the nominating committee. It was my last Thursday as chair of WFRC. It's a 2-year term. And we've got 7 counties that are part of that. And really through our big MPO, we've got about 85% of the state's population that are part of that. And the nominating committee made their recommendations. And for the first time in the history of the organization, which is older than me, they nominated the same person to serve a consecutive 2nd term as chair. That has never happened. So it was also my first day, my 2nd term. Yeah. So, yeah, that's what it is. And so,
well, I feel even better about the Wasatch Front Regional Council.
Everybody's heard it. So, it's a good place for us to be in, and it's an important seat for us to have. It's a significant opportunity for us to get to be part of that and to always know what's going on and how it can affect us and to be ahead of things. In the past, I know there was a feeling in South Jordan that maybe there were things that were happening that we didn't get to be part of the decisions and part of the allocations,
right,
and part of the
yep.
being in the know. And the way to be in the know is to put yourself in the know, and we're there. So
sure. Thank you.
It's a good opportunity.
Thank you for your service there.
Mayor, do you want me to plan on voting in your stead at LPC unless you're
If you would, I will text you and let you know, but since I'll be in the conference, I don't know if there's a way I'm going to be able to pull out to join LPC or not. Andrew will also be interested in listening into LPC, and Miranda will be there as well. I would say yes, plan on voting for that, and I'm sure we'll probably text about different things with our LPC text to make decisions and stuff, but if you could do that, I would appreciate that. Yeah, thank you. So yeah, and the rest I think we'll talk about more later. There's still a lot in flux, but yeah, the council had heard that before, but just for everybody else's information, that's where it's at. So two more years, we'll have the opportunity to chair WFRC. Okay, let's talk about our regular council meeting, our whopping agenda. Actually, sometimes they're really long and sometimes they're not, and it's not terrible either way, but you know, we might get out a little earlier tonight, and that is okay. We have one item on it. We've got a public hearing. We're going to discuss the planned development floating zone. We've talked about that in our front runner rail line area. I know it went to Planning Commission, and I think came out with a favorable recommendation from the Planning Commission. And so, anyway, that's the only item, agenda item, tonight on our council. Does anybody have any questions about that for this meeting right now? Okay. Well, then let's move on. We are looking forward to this item E1. We have a presentation. We're going to turn it to our Director of Planning, Mr. Stephen Schaefermeyer, to introduce us to a candidate for the Planning Commission.
Hi. Yeah, so there was a vacancy in Councilman Shelton's district, and Lori Harding is here if you want to come join at the table. And he has nominated Lori Harding to fill that vacancy. So Lori, this is the council. If you want to maybe just introduce yourself and then Mayor.
Awesome, I'm Lori Harding. I have been a resident of South Jordan for over 20 years. I live on Whispering Sands Drive. Do you want me to have a seat?
Yeah, you're welcome to have a seat. Yeah, that's great.
Sorry.
Wife of coming on 35 years, mother of three beautiful young adults. Empty nester, but I currently work for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints as a welfare and self-reliance manager, and I support the entire city of South Jordan and our congregations for those that are in need and helping them find resources, as well as working directly with the city in emergency response to keep that communication going. So when Dawn reached out to me, I was very excited to learn a little bit more about the opportunity. And I welcome any questions that you have for me.
Anyone have any questions for Lori?
Could I say just
yes, we would love to hear from you. Yeah.
First off, I met Lori through her work and then church. So I am the self-reliance specialist in our stake. And so she has supported me and been very effective in that, very helpful, I believe. And I appreciate her service there. Her employment there. I'm also aware that she has served on a lot of boards and different commissions and so forth. And Lori, maybe even talk to us a little bit about your civic service, if you don't mind.
So I consider myself a recovering banker. I came over to the church after working 20 plus years for Zions Bank. So I have a lot of experience that way with real estate and different loans and funding for both individuals as well as businesses. And so I'm a little well-versed in that area. But through that time of working at Zions Bank, as well as with the church, I've served on a few boards, currently on the board of YWCA, as well as a committee with Raise the Future. My three beautiful young adults are all adopted, and Raise the Future helps to find homes for those that are in the older ages of those in foster care. So I'm very connected to that demographic as well. But over the years, I've done a number of different boards and or committees, including the Utah State PTA. Being a mom, it's really important to stay on top of what's happening in schools. And so that's a prior passion. I've kind of put that aside a little bit and focused more on YWCA lately, though.
That's how Lori and I met.
Yeah.
Was through PTA, because we both did PTA for a
and
long
then with,
time.
I think also just stayed in connection with the city with 9/11 and our days of service. Yep. That's something too with Just Serve that I'm integrated in my region. So I've experienced that way too.
Awesome. PTA moms keep the world running.
Yes, they do.
They do.
Yes, they do.
Nothing more powerful than a passionate mom.
Anyone have any questions for Lori?
Thank you.
No. Well,
for all your service.
She has done a lot for this community and a lot of volunteer work, a lot of time donated to good causes. And I know you had the chance, you did an interview, like you sat down and visited. Yeah. Not only did you contact her, but you also did like a whole interview. And
that's true. Yeah, I interviewed Lori and I interviewed another candidate who had submitted an application. Very talented people. It was a tough decision, to be honest. But I felt like Lori's experience and her service in various boards and committees and so forth really weighed heavily in her ability to serve on our planning commission and do a good job with that. And so I appreciate your willingness to serve, Lori. I really do. I don't know. I think it's one thing to be part of an angry crowd, but it's a whole other thing to be on the other
facing
side
the angry crowd
of the dais from an angry crowd and having to, sort out reality from emotion, and respond in a rational way, and then also to work respectfully with your peers on the commission. I think those are sometimes challenges, and I think your experience will lend itself to that very well. So thank you very much.
Awesome. Well, I have a friend who is an employee of the state that works in one of the departments of the state, and there was a vacancy that just came about fairly unexpectedly on the city council in the city that he lives in. And he applied, one of the folks that put their name in and was chosen to fill that vacancy. And so he posted, hey, guess who's the newest council member here? This just barely happened. And a member of the legislature, I think, commented best that said, if you are appointed to any kind of position like this, you're lucky enough to get sworn in and then sworn out. So buckle up, that's kind of how it goes. So anyway, just... That kind of goes along with it. So, but I do think having a breadth of experience helps make that a little bit. There's a broader understanding, yeah. For what you're getting into, right? What you're offering to do, and it's really important work.
I think it's also notable that before Lori consented, she had a conversation with Mr. Schaefermeyer and learned more about the Planning Commission role and.
I try not to scare people away.
But I think that's notable that she reached out and wanted to talk to you.
Sure.
Definitely.
What am I getting myself into? Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so good.
I appreciate that as well.
Okay. Well, our process is that anytime we're looking at an appointment, we go through this process and then we have a conversation ourselves and then somebody will contact you tonight. Let you know. Yeah. Okay. Thanks so much, Lori. Appreciate it. Stephen, thank you.
Thanks,
all right, we're going to keep Stephen here. Our next item for discussion this is the right agenda. Kind of two different agendas. Is the Weedon Acres flag lot overlay zone and development agreement? I think we have a few things to kind of figure out here and make sure that we better understand and figure out where the council's at and where you want to go. So, Mr. Schaefermeyer, we'll turn to you and then we'll take it away.
Yeah, I'll give you some quick background here. So, this is an application for a flag lot overlay zone. So this is the first using this tool. It came before the Planning Commission in September. And there was a positive recommendation. It is a rezone. It's a rezone that requires a development agreement. So you can rezone it, but if there's not a development agreement, you can't do anything under the zone. So they came to City Council, and correct me if I'm wrong, the dates in my head. They came to City Council in November, the beginning of November, and then again in December. So at that December meeting, with a vote of 3-2, the zone was approved, and a vote of 2-3, the development agreement was not. So at that time, the understanding was they would come back to the council. Since that time, we've passed a pending ordinance on the flaglot overlay zone to take a step back and look at, based on this experience and also the applications we have coming, whether we need to make some changes there. After our last discussion, planning is now working on those changes, which include a prohibition against detached ADUs in the flaglot overlay zone. We're going to present most likely an administrative path rather than a legislative path. Obviously, we will take the council's direction once we've worked that through with the Planning Commission about the path you want to take. What Miguel is the assigned planner. If you haven't met Miguel, this is Miguel. Miguel's
the
assigned.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, he works. He's part of the planning team. What he's passed out to you is the developer obligations from the development agreement, as well as some exhibits, including the plat map. I'll turn your attention to that first. It says page 2. It's page 2 of the development agreement. Number D3. D3 is the accessory dwelling unit provision, which prohibited detached ADUs, or what we call guest houses. This was the provision that was added after that first meeting with City Council. So between the first meeting with City Council and the second, because of some concerns that we heard, and in an effort to address those, they added that provision. The question here tonight, and I'll let obviously the applicants speak, but the question tonight is, what do you want to see in the development agreement? Should we be bringing back the development agreement to make the rezone possible? This is kind of unprecedented, to be honest. I've never dealt with a situation like this where the rezone was approved, but the development agreement was not. So the assumption was there were some challenges with the development agreement, but I'll just be honest, after that December meeting, I didn't understand what exactly those challenges were. And so this discussion is to help the applicants understand what the challenges are, and if there's an opportunity to fix them, then this would return to you for a vote. You would pass it by resolution. If you pass the development agreement by resolution, then they are able to utilize the rezone that they were approved. So with that, I don't know, Mayor, do you
wanna... But the rezone has been approved, but it can't be used, is not in effect,
exactly.
And can't be used without a development agreement.
Yeah, the way that the zone was written is that the development agreement is required.
Okay. Okay, then we're going to let you just take it away with your presentation, unless you want the council to just jump in with their thoughts. But I think it's best if you guys go first.
Council discussion would be great.
Okay, so this was in November, right?
November and December.
Yeah.
Oh, October. October and then
December.
And then December.
Yeah, with the most recent meeting being that first one in December,
mm-hmm.
that early December, right?
And excuse me, we have Laurel Bevins and...
Dan Mylar.
I was going to call you your dad, and I knew it was wrong. Mr. Mylar.
And just to clarify, that Arl Bevins is here on behalf of the Mylars.
Yes.
And not in her role as a planning commissioner.
Yeah. Okay. So is there, I mean, council, if there's something in the development agreement that's written in there right now that is the reason that it didn't pass, but the rezone did, can we figure that out and see what it is and if there's any opportunity that they can change it to reach a point where it does meet the council's expectation or not? My understanding it was a 3-2 vote, is that right? Because remember, that was the night I wasn't here. And so it was a 3-2 vote, but so.
It was a 3-2 vote both times, but.
Yeah. So Patrick, do you have thoughts? You're the one that switched on those. And what do you want in the development agreement to help you? Because I think you voted for the rezone, but you voted against. Is that how it went?
Oh, do you have any thoughts, Cameron? Go ahead.
I voted in favor both times. Mm-hmm. They voted against both times. So I think we need to come together on where we can.
I voted in favor both
times. You and
times.
I worked together on mm-hmm. it.
Okay. So.
So, I mean, when I look at the development agreement, I think it's pretty typical of our development agreements, with the exception of bullet point number D3, which prohibits exterior accessory dwelling units. And I was in favor of that provision because I know that we're increasing the density in the subdivision already, and I didn't want to allow us to be in a position where we could significantly, you know, beyond what we're anticipating, increase the density in the subdivision until perhaps years down the road when another council has a different thought about it. So anyway, that's why I was in favor of that provision. I think Tamara, you and I are pretty much on the same page on that.
Could I add one question for clarification? If we're talking about not allowing an accessory dwelling unit in this
A detached,
right. We could do an internal, but not yes. detached. But that's not being placed across the city. That's just this, because I'm in favor of detached ADUs, but in this situation, I'm okay to say let's keep it internal.
Yeah, the way that the zone was written and the reason there's a development agreement is I think the idea at the time was if you don't have a significantly larger lot in a subdivision, by subdividing that through the flag lot, you may create unintended consequences or issues, conflicts with neighbors. And so this gave the council an opportunity to look at particular specific situations.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, we're working towards maybe providing some better standards, whether it's through this tool or another tool for future applications. But when this was passed, it was then several years before anybody took advantage of it.
Yeah.
And so the idea was, how do we provide some certainty instead of just giving the ability to do a flag lot? You can put the house wherever, you can put accessory buildings wherever. You know, in some cases, adjacent lots may have a house that's closer to a specific property line. And this was the tool at the time that was adopted to give the city council in particular the opportunity to place specific conditions or restrictions through a development agreement.
Yeah, to concur with John, I feel good about it. I think it's a great use of the land. I think it's a great, respectful use of the land. It's putting in a lovely home. I have no problems with it. I would hope that we can pass it. I think in this situation, an internal ADU is definitely a nicer use of the space, not adding another roof line. Mr. Mylar was forthright with us. And so he said he wanted to do an ADU. And let's be real factual and honest. How many people in your neighborhood and your neighborhood are doing ADUs and nobody knows and they're not within the code anyway? So it's happening all over the city. I had a person come to city council one night. They stepped away. They called me later and they're like, I have a complete illegal ADU at my house. I'm like, yep, you and a lot of other people. So let's not penalize him for being forthright. I think we should. I think it's a good plan.
Okay, so of the three that voted no, I would love to hear from you and get your thoughts and see if there is anything that can be done to get this to a place where you're comfortable, or if there simply isn't. I just want to better understand that.
Well, I have a question for Attorney Luce. If we voted against the ordinance, can we vote for this? I kind of thought, if you voted against one, you should vote against the other.
So,
I mean, it would be the same logic, right?
So
taking them in turn. Logically, if you vote against the development agreement, but you voted for the ordinance.
Well, I voted the other
way. I know, but you voted no for both.
I'm only caring about how I voted.
Yeah, you voted no for both. But logically, that would mean that you're okay with flag lots in this place, at this location, but there's something in the development agreement, whether it's external aid use or another provision, you didn't like. And so once they align with what would get you to vote for it, then of course you'd vote to approve the development agreement because you're okay with it. If you voted no for the zone, or as you're saying, the ordinance, for applying a zone to this piece of property, it's saying you don't feel that this is right for a flag lot. For instance, under our administrative flag lot provisions, this wouldn't comply. So generally, this wouldn't be a flag lot. But because of a few situations, the council said, well, we want a little more flexibility so we can make that call in special, unique circumstances. This may not be one of the special, unique circumstances. This may be, in your opinion. Certainly doesn't comply with what our administrative rules are.
I
with
never
different
voted
things.
In favor of flag lots.
So. Yeah, but I'm saying, and part of this, you inherit as you come on and off the council type thing. But from the standpoint of, if you voted that you don't think the zone should apply to these two lots, then you're saying, I just don't feel comfortable with flag lots, regardless of what the development agreement says, being here. If you split the vote, obviously you're saying, and then if you vote no to that, then obviously the development agreement, even if it's great, it's still, you don't feel it's appropriate. If you split the vote, then you're saying, great with the application of the zone, not so great with the terms of the agreement. I couldn't see, it'd be very hard to say I'm good with the agreement, but I don't like the zone there.
Okay, so
because if you don't like the zone there, you don't like the zone there, regardless of what the agreement says. And then finally, if you say, I like the zone there and I like the agreement, I'm fine with whatever those provisions are. You know, this specific one, it seems to be ADUs are kind of in the middle of this, might be other things. But whatever the provisions are in the agreement. But if you don't feel comfortable applying the zone to that piece of property, then by extension, I don't see why the agreement is as good as it is, why you'd ever feel comfortable on the agreement, because you wouldn't want this on there in the first place.
So that's exactly how I feel.
Okay.
Well said, Kathy.
Yeah, which I think leads us to Mr. Harris. Because I think you're
Ryan summed up the way that I feel about it too. That, I mean, the agreement itself, I don't really see any glaring issues with. I just don't feel like these lots, that whole subdivision should be turned into flag lots.
Makes sense. Okay.
So I'll give how I feel about it. And that is, I think there's a lot of people that have large lots, you know, in South Jordan. And for many of these people, they've had these large lots, and many people are aging, and it's harder for them to take care of these large lots. In many cases, people really struggle to take care of them. And I've seen many, I'm not saying these particular lots, but just in general, I've seen many large lots that are not well kept, you know, and there's a lot of stuff that's stored on them, and they're just, they're, you know, some people, neighbors maybe consider them to be an eyesore. At the same time, we also have a number of people that are needing new homes, you know, and so, and I think if it's done the right way, I think it can make sense, you know, to have a home on a flag lot. The issue that I have with when we were talking about this and why I voted the way I did, and I still feel comfortable with the way I voted, by the way, so, I don't like legislating accessory dwelling units. You know, I think, you know, it seemed like last council meeting work session, we talked about it, how most of the cities, it's administrative issue, you know, it goes through administration versus legislation. And I really think that's how it should be. I don't think that we should be using development agreements and saying, hey, we were going to restrict this, you know, accessory dwelling units. I don't feel good about that process. We haven't done it in the past. And it felt a little arbitrary to me. So that's the reason I said I didn't like that process. Since then, we got together as council and we've discussed these things. And I would be okay now that if it is consistent with what direction that we're giving staff on an administrative basis, I would be okay approving it on a basis that's consistent with that.
Okay.
Is that clear?
No.
It's not? Were you there at the last meeting? Or?
Yeah, I was
okay,
there.
Okay, this you, Mayor? Okay.
Yeah, I understand.
Do we need a...
But that won't apply to this because this is prior.
We're talking about today. We're talking about right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's just saying if it's consistent with what's coming,
yeah,
then he's okay with it, if I'm understanding.
That's correct.
So you want us to amend the development agreement consistent with what we talked about in the notice of pending ordinance meeting?
That is what I am comfortable with.
I have a question. Is with legislation under consideration at the Capitol right now, should the legislature decide to make a broad sweep at accessory dwelling units, is that going to make all of this moot anyway? Or is it going forward, should something pass saying that you can put exterior accessory dwelling units anywhere you want? That's what they're considering.
That's a good question, because that bill just really hasn't got enough beaten up that I know. Because like last time the internal ADU started really broad, no restriction. And in the end, it was quite a bit tighter. It's only in primarily residential zones. It had the lot size limit. And I just don't know if the external ADU discussion is that far. I haven't heard that it's that far. And I've been
to
a lot of the stuff.
My guess is that it will... change over
the vetting
process.
I know it won't be just like Representative Ward.
Do you know
Ward
if it would be can it be retroactive, or is it on anything new going forward?
What
are we voting on this, and it doesn't even matter after the legislative session, or do we know yet?
Let me answer your question in phases. As far as retroactivity, the way they did the last internal ADU one, they said if it applies, and then they carved out some exceptions, and then the following year they took some of those exceptions out. And the reason they did that is they were doing it in phases on purpose. So that made sense. So it didn't matter. You could have an existing house. If you complied with what they passed at that time, then you could at that time then put in an internal ADU. So I would imagine if it complies with what is passed, you could have an external ADU. Now, what I don't know, so that's phase one. I think that answers your question. As to retroactivity, it would apply across the board. It wouldn't necessarily be retroactive. It would supersede and basically replace any existing regulations we have on
it. I think that's a better way to state my question.
So
yeah.
Now the second part of it, though, is where I just don't know. Representative Ward's bill is quite broad.
Right.
Now, if it happens like it did last time, and I know they're negotiating it and stuff, and I can find out more about where they're at. The broadness may be narrowed down. So there may be a lot size requirement. There may be only in certain residential areas of certain type of zoning. And so it's really hard to say now without seeing a passed bill.
The lot size has already been adjusted, I believe, in one iteration already with that bill. So
And it might be adjusted more. And so that those are all the things that are being negotiated. And so it's really hard for me to say how it would affect this. It would likely apply to our whole citywide, but what's going to apply?
Yeah. Okay.
I just can't predict right now.
Okay.
Ask me in about 30 days.
Right. Well, I think more than anything, I just wanted everyone here to know that, I mean, this is a big decision, and it's very specific, and it's being decided on, and it might be superseded by, 30 days from now or something, and we'll just wait and see. But I think at this point we proceed with what we have the authority and the ability and the decision making opportunity to do here, and then we'll see what happens.
Now the one thing it wouldn't do is if there's an agreement saying I will not use my property for X, Y, or Z, regardless of statute, agreement, people can agree to do things that otherwise they're permitted to do by statute. And so they can agree to give up some of the opportunities they have under the statute, and say, no, I will give up those opportunities for this opportunity. So for example, while ADUs, external ADUs, may be legislated, flag lots on these lots are not even on there. So if someone really wants a flag lot, they may give up the ADUs to get the flag lots.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And they can do that by agreement. Because these flag lots, absent your legislation,
that's non-issue this year, legislature. I haven't heard anything about flag lots. There's nothing coming there. And so while the ADUs may apply, and very frankly, I mean, let's just think of two lots like this. If you were to do nothing and let them sit as is, and the ADU language came down and said you can do an ADU at this size, they could put two ADUs on those, the two current lots, and then they have the two houses, two ADUs, and it'd be essentially just very close, probably not as big, because the ADUs are going to have size limitations as you approving flag lots. But they'd have, like, the drive entrances would be different. And those things that you control with flag lots would be quite a bit different, and they wouldn't be two independent lots. But as far as just four living structures, you might end up the same there. So the flag lots thing is totally under your control. There's no discussion of that I know of at the legislature. I haven't heard anything about that. The ADUs is a different thing. Now, if you were to give two extra lots in the flag lots, and I have four legal lots, and ADUs come in and say they can have those, then you have eight living units on four lots rather than four living units on two lots. And you control that decision through your zoning.
And if I could just add, when the internal ADU legislation came out, it also invalidated HOA,
there is language saying that HOA contracts are not enforced. No one's challenged that under the contract clause of the Constitution.
But it didn't go as far.
I'm told the person who put that in, I disagree with their legal analysis.
But it didn't go as far as addressing development agreements and other. It's an argument we get into a lot with Daybreak, for example, right?
Yeah.
So just to that point of, we don't know. We work with what we have.
Well, I would say the development agreement, unless it's specifically called out, that this also supersedes any agreement of any type, which the internal didn't. It only addressed HOAs. Short of that, and then if they did that, cities would have very little incentive to do development agreements with developers more, and at least the big developers I work with quite often, I know that that is not a bridge they want to cross, because they depend a lot on development agreements to get a lot of the things worked out. They actually really like them.
Yeah.
So, did that make sense?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That was additional context that I think just needed to be considered, you know, in this conversation, heard in this, not even considered, just heard, you know, when we talk about this. So, with the input from Mr. Harris and his thoughts and knowing, and from everybody else, hearing where everybody else is at, it sounds like we have two council members feel a certain way, two council members feel a certain way, and we hear how Mr. Harris feels. Does staff feel like you have what information you need? Does the applicant feel like you have information you need to potentially draw something up that could be presented to the council?
So,
I think it'd be good if either Mr. Harris or Mr. Schaefmeyer articulate what they think we said in that last meeting.
I'm happy to.
So we're on the same page.
And Joe is actually here. He got right to work on the revisions. He came to listen to this discussion to make sure nothing changed, and if it did, that he heard it. And obviously, the council is not committed to make any changes to the ordinance, right? All we did was take your input, and we will do our best to translate that into an ordinance, whether it's a legislative floating zone that includes some restrictions on ADUs, or we present, and this is the direction we're headed, an administrative one that lays out specific requirements. One of those requirements would be essentially D3, that you would not be allowed to build a detached accessory dwelling unit on a flag lot. Whether that's, again, in the legislative form of the ordinance or an administrative form that we would present, that's what we plan to present to the council. Based on what I heard tonight, this language is in line with the direction we thought we heard. And so my plan is obviously to ask the applicant when they want to come back and find a time on the council agenda and present this same agreement with that understanding.
Which the council would at that time consider.
Yeah, right.
And honestly, I agree that I don't think decisions like this should ever feel or be arbitrary.
Yeah.
I agree with that. I think there are some cases where there are unique circumstances, but I think broadly a policy such as this, it is best to keep it.
Well, and I'll comment.
I
think there's a lot of value that, you know, the city staff came and they did a lot of research what's going on in other cities. It's a very good presentation where we had an in-depth conversation to see what that looks like, you know. And we talked about, you know, should this be legislative? Should this be administrative? You know, and I think there's a lot of good that came from that. You know, I really do think these types of things, because a lot of times when these things come before councils, it's an emotional plea from residents that are there. You know, you have people that are, you know, I've lived here for so long and this is tough, and we get this all these emotional pleas, you know, in here, and I would rather have it be, and that's how almost all those cities that were referenced, you know, at the last work session were. This is an administrative issue. If it meets the guidelines, it meets the guidelines. And so really kind of where we left off is it's one or the other. You either have, you know, you either have a flag lot or you have accessory dwelling units, but you don't get both. And that's kind of, you know, that's kind of where we left off. And I feel comfortable with that. And I feel comfortable with the process we went through.
Okay. Anybody have any other thoughts about that?
I will say, depending on how the state comes down, I just want to say the expectations. If you create flag lots without an agreement that says no accessory dwelling units, if we're just relying on our ordinance.
Yeah.
And if we create a flag lot and the state comes in later on and says, you can have external ADUs under these circumstances, and that flag lot and or the original lot meet those circumstances, there will be external ADUs.
I understand that.
Yeah, we're not there yet.
Yeah.
Because we just don't control that.
Right. And that'll be another body making a decision, not this.
Yeah,
body.
They would pass that, and then,
somebody else gets to
work
on that.
But if you have the agreement, then we would just say, no, the agreement says you will not build those.
Yeah.
So our timing, what's our timing on the ordinance again? I ask him this daily.
So
it's March?
Yeah, we're trying to get to the Planning Commission next week, and that would get to you the first meeting in March.
Would be the ordinance. If we need to wait to see what the tea leaves are at the legislature.
That's the last week of the session. The first meeting in March is the last week of the legislative session. There will be three more days after that, and that's usually when most things come through.
We can certainly push it off this one to address any issues that came up at the legislature. So in the meantime, we have this application. We have another application that vested before we did the pending ordinance. They have a very similar provision in there, if not identical, in their proposed development agreement. It hasn't gone to Planning Commission yet, so that will take some time. And then we got another application in this neighborhood on this street after the pending ordinance came about. So they're the ones that are sort of in limbo to wait and see what we do with the
ordinance. I wouldn't recommend that we wait on anything. I don't want to hold anybody up. I think this body has the decision-making authority to make a decision about this. And if that's the schedule that you're on, keep the schedule. That's how we do things. We'll wait and find out how a lot of things come down from the legislature,
right,
and then we'll figure it out and go
we'll
forward.
Adjust.
You know, yeah, we'll make adjustments.
Yeah,
I wouldn't. My recommendation wouldn't be throwing anybody off a schedule that's already been proposed.
And I think the applicant has clarity of where this is going to go.
But at the same time, Mayor, is it okay if I make
Yes, go
comment?
Ahead. Yeah.
At the same time, an applicant may want to say, well, wait, that may affect me a certain way and want to wait too.
Mm-hmm.
And an applicant can hold their, they're coming to you at their place too.
And no vote was taken tonight.
Yeah,
it's just direction of what to bring back to you for you to consider in that setting.
Right. With the understanding that it's still just a consideration. There's no guarantees of anything. Okay.
And for everybody's reference, since we've talked about it a lot, it is HB 88, sponsored by Representative Ray Ward, and the floor sponsor in the Senate is Senator Lincoln Fillmore.
It's a chalk committee bill, essentially.
It is not a chalk committee bill.
No, it's not.
No, that would be Representative White and Fillmore. They're jointly running all chalk committee because CHA is the Commission on Housing Affordability. It's a state board, and Senate and the House both have a representative. Representative White, I'm not remembering his first name.
Stephen
Wright. Stephen Wright. He's
Wright
the
or
White.
White.
W-H-Y-T.
W-H-Y-T, yeah. He is, all the CHA bills will come with those two.
Commission on Housing
Affordability. Abbreviated CHA. And that the two bills I'm sure are theirs is, I believe it's SB 81, and that deals with parking and a bunch of other stuff, and it's going to be amended and changed. And the other one is HB 368, and that one is about 7,000 lines and has a bunch of provisions, and we're still working through. And
it takes out, these bills take out housing, the ability to choose any parking, the ability to choose any exterior requirements at all. Take all of that out.
They're still in heavy negotiation.
I read
if
it.
Jared Tini had any hair, it'd be falling out today when I was talking with him, and he's dealing with 368.
You said has with 88, 368, and what was the other one?
Those two.
So no, no. So the CHA bills, the Commission on Housing Affordability specifically, are House Bill 368 and Senate Bill 91. It's either 81 or 91. I believe it's 91. The bill dealing with ADUs, which is not a Commission on Housing Affordability bill, is HB 88 by Representative Ray Ward, and then floor sponsor is Senator Fillmore.
Yeah.
Okay.
And if you want, I can send that to you if I want that. Would you like, Mayor and Council, as this is going to the Planning Commission, the draft that... We're going to be circulating Planning Commission. Would you like to see that in your inboxes so you can read through it too before time? And you want to vet it through Planning Commission, then see it.
Okay, I'd like to see it.
I'm okay to have the Planning Commission.
I like going through the normal channels.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of times you'll see them beforehand. It just depends. So I don't know that there's, but we'll send it out, read it if you want to.
Okay.
Good. Sounds good. Okay.
Or have time.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Can I
go
say
ahead.
One thing?
Yes, you can.
I just want to express admiration for the work that you guys are doing. I've had very little exposure. I'm in the industry, but I've had very little exposure to this, and I appreciate it. It does impact me, obviously. Fortunately, I'm not in any particular rush because these things take time. But well done. I just want to say that to all of you. I think you're all doing really, really careful thought and good work, and I value that. So thank you for having me today, and this has been helpful for me to kind of understand what and why, right? If someone looking from the outside might say, well, we're probably going to go back with the same thing and maybe it'll get approved or whatever. But it's like, no, there's good reasons that Councilman Harris had, you know, for the approach he took, and the Councilman McGuire and everyone has for the way that they're doing it under council from Ryan Luce, etc. So anyway, hopefully that's okay for me to take 1 minute to say, but thank you all. I really appreciated being in this meeting and the work you're doing. So
thank you. Appreciate that. And I actually wish more people had the chance to hear how well this council had vets things, how thoughtful their commentary and their votes are. This body is the farthest thing from a rubber stamp. Everybody takes the time to really go through and understand and be able to speak to why. So I'm glad you were here to hear it, and I appreciate you saying that. Thank you. Okay, let's move on. Item F2, we have Chief Carr here. What we've got. Chief, Deputy Chief, both here. We appreciate you being here. We're going to talk about some statistical trends in law enforcement. This is an update that we get just about annually, about every year or so, pretty close to that.
We haven't done it in a while. It's been a little while.
We go through and get some good information about, you know, kind of where things are at. The PD always has their finger on the pulse of exactly, you know, what's going on and what the trends are, and I appreciate the chance to be updated about it, and I think there's a lot of narratives that exist right now that we'll be able to better understand if they are accurate or not. And so I appreciate you being here, and
well,
we're going to turn it to you.
Give you some clarity on some of that.
So, do you want to do that, or do you want me to?
Just the next slide. So, this is a 1929 Model A. And in 1929, you could buy that for about $450.
And this, the reason it's up there is because in 1929, the FBI started the UCR program, the Uniform Crime Reporting Program. So we can go to the next slide. So why in December of 2020 was there a story in the USA Today? It's because they changed the way we do business and what we count to determine what crime rates are. So up until the end of 2020, for nearly 100 years, 90 years, we only tracked, for purposes of creating a crime rate for cities across the country, those eight things. So four crimes against persons, homicide, robbery, rape, and aggravated assault, and four against property, burglary, larceny, motor vehicle theft, and arson. That's the way the world worked. Okay, so next slide. So in 2019, this was from the Crime in Utah report. And those eight categories in 2019, before it ended in 2020, created a crime rate for us. And you can see some of the other cities and what their crime rates were in 2019. And those things at the bottom there, in that year, we counted 67 crimes against persons and 1,118 crimes against property. We tally those together. You use a little formula, a little math, better than what I got at West High School, but they do their thing, and you get, or West Jordan High School.
Easy.
And you get a crime rate of 15.26, which means there were 15 crimes for every 1,000 residents that we have in the city. Okay? All right. So that's this was in 2019. And
before they changed the reporting.
Before they changed the way we report. Okay? So let's go to the next slide and give you an idea of what we're looking at. So the old system, which is called the summary or index system, we counted those four things. In the new NIBRS, the National Incident-Based Reporting System, we count all of those things into our crime rate for crimes against persons. So you can see we added quite a bit of stuff that happens. It was happening in every city across the country anyway. It wasn't being used to calculate the crime rate. So this is actually a much more comprehensive system that allows us to really kind of know what's going on in our communities across the country. Next slide. So then we have the crimes against property, and we were only counting those four prior to 2021. And now we've added a whole host of crimes that we now look at and can look at on a year-to-year basis, all of those things. And then on top of that, next slide, we added crimes against society. Now, we have been submitting those, but they were never looked at regarding crime rates. So now all of those types of violations were added into our crime rates. Makes some sense. Next slide. So just a reminder, this is the one from 2019, and our crime rate was 15.26. If you look closely, ours is about a quarter of what Salt Lake's was.
It's so much lower than most of those up there.
Yeah, there's about 63, so it's about four times, their crime rate's about four times, right? So go to the next slide. So this is 2021. This is the first year of the new system, okay? And our crime rate jumped to about 34 crimes per 1,000. But look at Salt Lake's. It's about 152. Again, probably four times. It was 63 and 15. Okay. So it's 34 and 152. All I'm trying to say is everybody's crime rate went up because we were measuring a number of things that we were never measuring before. So this will give us a better grasp of kind of what's going on in our communities.
This was 2019.
No, this is 2021. This is the first full year of the NIBRS system, the first full year. So you might ask, well, where's 22, 23, and 24, right? That's So I get on the BCI's website, Crime in Utah, and the latest one on there is 2021. So I call the Commissioner of Public Safety, and I said, hey, what's the deal? we should have at least, I know they're a year behind, but I was expecting to get 22 and 23. And he said, well, I don't know. Let me call my people and find out. So he calls them and he says, well, they've been working on this dashboard for a couple of years and they were working on that. And don't have the crime in Utah report for 22 or 23. We'll see if we can get that to you at some point in the future. So we really don't have a way past 2021 right now to compare ourselves to other cities in the county or even across the state because there's no crime in Utah report.
Even against ourselves.
Yeah. Well, we can do it, and I'll show you. We can do a little bit for ourselves, and we did. So the next slide. Okay, so this is our own data from 21, 22, 23, and 24. This comes out of our RMS system and our CAD system, so our records management system and our computer-aided dispatch system. These are our numbers. In 2021, was the first year we went to a new records management system. And everybody in the county is now on the same records management system, which is a really good thing because we don't have to look at another system to try to find out what's going on, okay? All right, so green is good, red is not so good in our little analysis here. And looking at from 23 to 24. So the number of calls in 24 actually went down 7%. That's a good thing. We think that that's a really good thing. There were less generated incidents in the city.
Because they're going online to report things?
No, the online would be caught in there. It's actually a decrease in the number of calls and proactive things that we were doing.
And considering it's the lowest out of the entire 4 years, it didn't just go down the year before. That's the lowest number of all
years. Yeah, and it's, you know, they bounce around a little bit, and that's to be expected because of things happening. But we're not sure exactly why. We're still looking at that to see, because some of those red numbers indicate that there's some, you know, things going on that we wish weren't, like our arrests went up in 24. And you can see in 4 years, the amount of arrests have gone up, you know, substantially, right? Accidents are down a little bit. 3% down. 911 hangups are interesting. These are the butt dials to the VEC center. When you butt dial 911, essentially, those are going down. They're headed in the right direction, which we appreciate because it's difficult for us to have to deal with those to determine, you know, is there a history with this number? How much effort are we going to put into it? So we like to see that going in the right way. Reckless driving, going the wrong way.
What's defined in reckless driving?
What's that?
What is reckless driving?
Well, it'd be like road rage, those types of things. Okay. You usually have to have, three
moving violations.
Yeah,
it's really been enhanced with the road rage stuff.
It's the road
over
rage.
Over the last year, especially. Okay.
So we're seeing
we're getting
an
a lot
increase
of
in that.
In regards to that.
Misdemeanors are up. Felonies are down. You know, honestly, I would probably take that.
All day.
Our priority 1 to 3 calls are going down. These are the ones that are traffic accidents with injuries or crimes in progress. You know, those kinds of things. It's going down. The trend that we don't like to see necessarily is the 3+ officers being dispatched to a call. So we see that going up about 15% from the previous year. Again, this is stuff like maybe a really active domestic or even a suspicious vehicle or something going on. Can you think of other
ones? Yeah, a lot of times that's more of we need 2 to respond to stop behavior and 1 to be roving, looking for something.
Looking for something kind of going on.
So,
and as Jason pointed out today, as we looked at these earlier today, he says, well, that's like an average of 12 a day, and I'm like, oh yeah, you didn't go to West High, you figured that.
Bingham High.
Granger High.
Anyway, so it's a mixed bag, you know, but for the most part, and I think the next slide will help us understand that even better. There's one more slide. So this is, go ahead and go to that one, Matt, sorry. So the jail provides this every month to every agency. And that tells you actually where we sit as far as taking people that actually get booked into jail. So you can see the 22 number was 371 and the 23 number was 417. And then we went up a little bit to 426. The interesting thing about that, you can see all of those agencies, there's 43 agencies that booked people in jail last year. And we were number 14 of 43 agencies. So we're a growing community. The interesting thing on this slide is the 28 minutes to book somebody. So when we actually take somebody to jail, there's the travel time getting there, which is about 20, 25 minutes. There's on average, depending on when you do it, if it's Friday, Saturday night, it's going to be longer. But it's about a half an hour to get them booked in and then another half an hour probably to get back. So at a bare minimum, the officer is out of the city for at least an hour and a half, probably more likely a couple hours, that he's going to be tied up. There are times where we make decisions to cite and release somebody based on the fact that we might be at minimum staffing, it's going to take 2 hours. It's not good for our residents not to have the person in the city. There's sometimes that happens. So that's what we wanted to point out with this one. Okay, the last slide is really the meat of it. So here is a lot of those activities that are now counted in our new NIBRS reporting. And we can't see the kidnapping and rape. Now, before you get too concerned about kidnapping, not to minimize it in any way, but these aren't stranger abductions, you know, that happen. So in 2021, we had 3. 2022, we had 2. 23, we had 3. And in 24, we had 9. So that's an increase of 200% from 1 year to the next. Those are all domestic related types of unlawful detentions, of spouses, custodial interferences. They get put into that category. Okay. And the rape, we went from 21 to 26 for a 24% increase.
Can we take that R off so we can see the top?
I'm not sure.
That's the Zoom.
That's the Zoom thing. So sorry about that. But you can see some of the red numbers below that. Robberies, we went from 6 to 12. Those are, you know, not all of them are like, you know, an armed robbery at a store or a bank or something like that. Sometimes if you have a couple of individuals and somebody uses force or fear, a gun, a knife, a, you know, threat to beat somebody up, they take their property, a cell phone, 2 kids, you know, somebody, you know, beats them up, takes their cell phone, that's technically a robbery, okay? So you might get some of those. And then the aggravated assaults are up. So you could say that the violent crime in our city is trending up, but the numbers are pretty darn small, so it's hard to tell, like from 1 year to the next, whether that's going to go up a couple, down a couple. It could go either way, and the percentages look bad. For these other that are in green, those are obviously, well, simple assault, that's still a crime of violence, that's down. Burglary, down. And if you look back to 21, 148, now we're only had 54. We think technology is helping with that. We think yes, that, you know, the people have it on their phones and those types of things, the Ring doorbells. We think as those expand, that happens. I tell the story. I worked burglaries for the sheriff's office back in the late 80s, early 90s. I would have 40, and I covered holiday, and that's all I covered. And we'd have 40 in a month sometimes, you know. Wow. So it's really gone in the right direction. And we just don't see a lot of residential burglaries anymore. We get some garage burglaries, we get some business burglaries, but actual, you know, where they break into your home, steal stuff, we're not seeing a ton of those, which is good, right? Shoplifting is driven obviously by how aggressive our loss prevention people are at Walmart or Target or whatever. And we do see, like last year, we knew that they did something different at Walmart because all of a sudden we were getting called there every day, you know. Mm-hmm. So something happened. I don't know, Rob, if we ever even knew if it was a new loss prevention person or program or philosophy.
Yeah, it goes up and down.
It does go
you
up.
You get some aggressive ones, and obviously that changes.
That changes us. We don't impact that a whole lot, is what I'm saying. Theft for motor vehicles, very interesting one, down 43% from last year, but look at 2021, 427. Now, I can't give you a reason for that per se. Now, we've discussed some stuff, and we think, you know, there are potentially some reasons for that, but I'll take that every day, all day, every day. Motor vehicle theft, look at that, down 88 to 50 last year. Down 43% again, but look at where it was in 21. Now, sometimes we have groups that are out there doing a ton of vehicle theft. And, you know, you get that group under control and it will have an impact in those kinds of numbers. But very good. Vandalism, down 10%. Drug violations and paraphernalia, stuff like that, down about 20%. Disorderly conduct, up a little bit. Driving under the influence, down a little bit, you know, 13% down. Again, some of the driving under the influence, that's the proactivity of officers. As we get busier, maybe they don't have as much time to, you know, to be out there just looking for a DUI, they're on a call, things like that. Nonviolent family offenses, down some, that's good. Trespass and other offenses, up. So it's a bit of a mixed bag, but considering what we're seeing, and Rob, you want to talk about the article that you...
Yeah, so, you know, one of the concerns was, you know, what's trends across the country? And I was really curious about, you know, how our data added up with trends across the country. And it's ironic that it mirrors what's going on across the country. And some of the reasons for that are really, they talk about demographics being... Generally, what we deal with more often than not is the males between 18 and 24. And society has changed from when zero technology as a police officer, right? And then,
it's true.
And then when I came up through South Jordan in the early 2000s, that age group or that demographic, it's different. And what they're doing is different. And where they live is different. And you're 18, it's time to go to college, go on a mission, get a job, get out of my house. That's not a thing anymore because they can't afford to go anywhere. They don't choose to do that. And so it was really interesting in a sense of, you know, they feel like social media has helped in regards to kids aren't going to parties like they used to and causing mayhem because they can just get on their phone. And do it not mayhem on them. But you know what I'm saying?
They did Piper a hack
and
now.
The price you pay to go commit, you know, these kinds of burglaries, vehicle burgs, and things like that, we're just not seeing it anymore. It's not beneficial. Go ahead.
I mean, just, and I know you don't necessarily have the exact numbers here probably, but, you know, of these, let's just say some of the more serious crimes, you know, how many of them are being committed by residents, you know, that live in our city versus people that are coming into our city committing these crimes?
You want to take that on me too?
Go ahead. You can give your spiel.
I would say that we're probably 50-50. And I say that from a perspective of there is some relation to South Jordan, whether it's the victim, whether it's our subject, our suspect. Yeah. Typically what you're going to see in terms of, you know, warrant arrests, the violent crimes that come, there is a nexus to South Jordan. I would say that when you look at, you know, the chief mentions the arrest number, when our arrest number goes up, I know from a council perspective that would cause pause, but as a cop, that's good. We're making arrests. We're stopping behavior. Yeah. We're influencing people who are committing those types of crimes in other areas too. And like the chief said, you know, as a profession, when West Jordan's making an arrest and when you see that booking time and how many people are being arrested for crime, it helps our city as well. And so I think arrest numbers are great. I know probably not in this forum, but I think that's a thing. And so when you say, you know, we're responding on give or take 40,000 calls a year. And when you look at these numbers and you associate them with how many contacts we're making on a regular basis, we're in really good shape as a city. I think
we are. Yeah. And I think the crime rate, even the one from 2021, tells you we're still in the lower, well lower half of the county. Now, I will also tell you that, you know, as the city expands and as other areas of the county expand and other areas become the suburbs, then we become more like, you know, a giant city. If you look at those crime rates, they all drop as you move away from the center of Salt Lake City. They just do, and it's happened forever. And it's the suburbs are different, and you know, but we're becoming a giant metropolis, you know, essentially between Ogden and Provo, to some degree. Somebody had it.
I know we've talked about this when we're budgeting and giving more officers, and we've talked about the mental health support that's completely changed for officers, that you're having a lot more of that.
Yeah.
How is that reflected in this as far as, obviously that's not robberies, but are you finding more related people having more crime against each other? Are you finding
I'm not sure. You started off talking about officers and then I got lost.
So my point is, we've talked several times about how we need to make sure we have enough officers on the scene because you have a lot of mental health problems going on.
We do have mental health issues, yeah.
So I'm just curious, we've talked about some of these arrests and robbery, but where does the mental health piece come into this?
There are mental health calls or?
Yeah, there's not enough mental health resources. I sat for 5 years on the state's Behavioral Crisis Response Commission. And now you've got 988, that's helpful. And they claim that they can help about 80 to 90% of the people who call in without that. Okay, so you've got that. You have MCOT, which Mobile Crisis Outreach Teams. They don't have nearly enough of them. And sometimes our officers will have to wait. And actually, they don't wait. They just end up dealing with it because they say, well, we're going to be 2 or 3 hours before we can get there. So the officers kind of figure out what to do and just move on. So they need more of those. The receiving centers are now a thing, and there's going to be about 5 in the state, and one is getting finished. It's going to be down by the jail. It's a no-refusal receiving center that a police officer can take somebody to the receiving center that's in crisis. They will take them. There's no refusal of them, and that can help get something taken care of because sometimes the only thing we can do is end up addressing the criminal aspects of whatever's happening. And so you end up taking them to jail, which is not the right place for them, you know, in those kinds of situations. So having a receiving center will certainly help with some of that. But we're way behind the curve. Across the nation, we're way behind the curve.
We do a lot of what we call pink sheets, where we take their civil rights and we put them in a medical facility.
Right.
From a law enforcement perspective, meaning they can't take care of themselves or they're a danger to themselves or others, or their suicidal ideation, those kinds of things. We make a lot of runs to the hospitals.
Are those all hospitals or do we have specific ones that take those kind of?
Well, we end up usually at.
Yeah, it depends. You know, a lot of times we want to keep them close to the border so they're available, obviously, for other calls. So Jordan Valley, the U, Riverton, that's usually our wheelhouse. Lone Peak and Draper, we do a little bit of that too. But we spend a lot of time in trying to provide resources or get MCOT on scene. And then from an officer's perspective, a lot of times we can't just walk away.
Yeah.
And when you see some of those trespass numbers, some of that plays too, in that they've refused treatment. We don't really have enough to take their civil rights and pink sheet them. And so the property owner just wants them removed. And so we ask them not to return. We issue a trespass notice. And because they haven't committed a crime, we let them continue to struggle. And, you know, sometimes that impacts other residents or, you know, in a same episode. And eventually, I guess, my point would be is we're not walking away from it 90% of the time. If we feel like they're a danger, we'll get them to the hospital. Which is also concerning from a law enforcement perspective in that, you know, sometimes that equates to some, you know, putting our hands on people because they don't want that. And so it's a balance. But we spend a lot of time training in terms of what to look for and what to identify, and the struggle between us and fire in determining, you know, what that looks like. I think fire's been great as far as helping us facilitate transports often. So,
is there any outreach to their families, these people who are borderline, that, you know, to try to get them resources so they can convince?
There is some of that that goes on, depending on what kind of case it is. We have our victim advocates that can help with some of that stuff, but the officers do have some information that they can give to people about those types of programs and things that are available for folks to get assistance.
Because yeah. I can see when they have a family member who's in this yeah. crisis or situation, they may not be at a point where you can actually do the things to take them off the street. Yeah. But if their family who has contact with them, if they have a resource that maybe they can get them the help. That
yeah, we do. I mean, the chief's right. A lot of people do have history where we can look up and identify some contacts. You know, the difficulty, the majority of the time is when it is when family's involved, that's usually best case scenario, right? It's the ones who have refused that or won't give us any information, or we contact family and they say, we're on our last, we've dealt with that a number of times.
Yeah, they've burned the bridge.
You know, and they're adults and they haven't committed crimes. And so it's a struggle.
And, you know, we're going to continue to grow. And we've, you know, the concern about having enough officers is always there. We have done some things. You guys approved the, what we call case service, which was the online reporting system. That's certainly going to help a ton going forward. We've also implemented draft one, which is artificial intelligence that helps the officer write their report based on their body camera interactions. And so it speeds that up, that process. And so that's been very helpful. We've also hired our first CSO, community services officer. You might see that truck running through the city now. And he is picking up all of the parking problems, abandoned vehicles, all those kinds of things that the officers otherwise would have to have their attention to. Because sometimes, frankly, people will call in and complain about something, and we put it on a list, and it's 3 weeks before we get through the list. I talked to Lieutenant Winder today, and he is cleaning those up so that when somebody calls, we're actually on it in a timely manner. So that's helpful. It also clears up the time for the other officers so they're available to be able to do what, you know, go on those three car calls and those kinds of things. So some really good things happening there.
This is really good information. I appreciate being able to see the data that shows that our city continues to grow. Overall, our crime rate numbers, they're not. Like, they're maintaining where they've been. The percentage is maintaining, and so many things have come down. That is a positive trajectory in so many ways. Far from perfect, but Rob just said that, 50%-ish maybe are folks coming from outside of South Jordan to do something potentially here in South Jordan who might be active. Yeah. In some way here in South Jordan. Is that right? Is
some
that what
kind
I heard?
Of nexus, yeah.
Correct. I mean, we have a lot of new residents, right? We still, and as they come in, we get familiar with them on occasion.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't think as we grow, I think this will be trending, you know, in this, you know, I don't feel like we're behind by any means. I think that you guys have provided us with what we need, and we'll try to continue to be efficient to offset some of these areas, because, you know, proactivity and being out obviously deters a lot of these things. And so our focus, the chief and I, is really to try to be, you know, look at ways to be more efficient in making sure we have available people.
And we want them to be seen. We have a program called On Every Street, where we hope to be on every street each quarter of the year in the city, at least. And the officers do a great job at that kind of thing. And being visible obviously helps. So, okay, that's our story, and I'm sticking to it.
Thank you. Thank you for all of your work. Thank you to your team. Please express our appreciation. To everyone who's part of the South Jordan Police Department, we appreciate you and the great work that you do to keep our folks safe, to abide by the law, all the things that you do. Thank you.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. All right, item F3, we have Brian Priest here with us, our Director of City Commerce, and we are going to talk about some policy amendments to the Public Infrastructure District policy, the PID policy, some policy amendments related to economic development and how this PID opportunity might actually become a tool in our toolbox that could help spur some economic development opportunities. What do you think? Take it away.
Absolutely. So we sort of alluded to this in our budget meeting last week that we'd be coming here with this with PIDs. In the 2019 legislative session, the legislature authorized PIDs. Basically, a PID is a financing tool. It's created as a district, something like a water district or a sewer district. Under the PID format, it must be approved by the city council. We have a process by where we have the district advisory committee that meets with the applicant and vets through and makes sure we're not wasting your time on either frivolous or incomplete types of applications. So we spend time with these. We have had one application. We have been going back and forth with that application. During that time, we've learned some things, and I, from my standpoint as the economic development director, I looked at a way that maybe we could make some changes to this policy that would actually be beneficial. Ryan can probably give you a much better explanation of what happened in the legislature when all this was going on, but we kind of took to heart when we did this policy, was it 21 or somewhere around there, that the original intent was for unique enhancements. And so if a developer wanted to come in and they wanted to do something like the Ramble in the park in the central district of the
urban center.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Something just really unique and special that was way beyond just infrastructure and things that they were normally required to do. That's what we would consider for a public infrastructure district. And as we've gone through this process with this particular applicant, and it's a commercial applicant. And let me back up a little bit. Councilman Zander asked me before the meeting, we talked a little bit about it, and I said, no, this has nothing to do with residential. Because quite frankly, I think they're a really bad idea for residential. I think you do too. And so what we're trying to do is create two paths, similar to what we did with the SAA when it was put together. Although it was one SAA, there was two paths in it. It was commercial that they continue to pay the assessments even after the property sold or was developed. With the residential, and rightly so, we wanted that for whatever particular property sold, its portion of that SAA paid off before it became developed and got building permits and stuff. So that way we don't have to, the residential people don't have to worry about them saying, wait a minute, why am I paying more taxes than the guy across the street for the same home, basically. And that was, that's a very valid concern. We've had a city or two built basically on SAAs in the past, and they've turned out to be really bad ideas. So we want to keep that very much the same as the policy that was adopted, or exactly the same, in that there would only be for certain type of unique enhancements that would be enjoyed by people in that area above and beyond what other people have. So Ben, back to the commercial, we'd like to maybe tweak that a little bit. And my, as I kind of reviewed state law and kind of preparing for this presentation, I think there's some good language in the state law that we can put in our ordinance that basically takes a commercial path, and it says that they can use it for a commercial project for public infrastructure improvements, not just unique enhancements. Things like water lines, sewer, water, natural gas, streets, roads, curb and gutter, parking facilities, public transportation. An interesting one, and you know, when I looked at it, I thought, that probably didn't apply, but I think it might. An inland port. Inland ports have the ability to create these, and we might create an inland port at some point. Case in point would be the Daybreak Commerce Park. It's not really, I had a meeting last week with one of the gentlemen that manages the inland port, and it doesn't really qualify until the CDA is gone, because you can't have two tax increment things on the same property. But in 8 or so years, when that CDA has run its course, then we might find it beneficial to create an inland port to help spur, you know, manufacturing and those types of things. And the other thing that also infrastructure improvements, facilities, buildings that are proposed as part of a remediation project, such as, and I'm struggling to remember the most common name to the jelly poop property.
Shoreline.
Shoreline. Okay, it's changed. So the shoreline property.
I knew exactly where you were going. I'm like, this guy might just say the poop farm, but that's what he means.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry. But anyway, so that's something that possibly, you know, would make sense in the future. You know, the process would still be roughly the same as far as getting approved. They would bring their proposal to us. They bring an initial proposal. We vet that, make sure it meets these criteria. Doesn't have to be. There's nothing in this now or in the future that says we have to approve these. If we just think it's a bad idea, even though it might meet some of these, but it's just not, I don't know, for whatever reason, it just doesn't make sense, we can say no. Correct? And so anyway, just kind of bringing this to you HB 151 took away so many of the tools that we built the city on, a lot of the tax increment, the RDA stuff that we, you know, and that we're still, a lot of them have lived their lifespans, but some of them are coming close and some of them have got some years to go, but we were able to create all that under the old world for, and you know, and that for retail stuff. We can still do some of that stuff for commercial and for others, but for the retail and for a sales tax base and stuff. And so really, as we participated in this district advisory committee, it kind of came obvious to me that we don't have a lot of land left for retail development. We do have some, and we don't have the tools to fill those gaps. We've never been a city that's bought economic development. We've always just tried to fill gaps that, you know, it just, they can't get there, but for we give them a little help. And this could be a way, probably didn't make very clear in the beginning, is they tax themselves. Now, this is not an additional tax that goes on our books. Loan or any financing that they do participate in better rates than they would on the open market, but it doesn't go against our taxing ability. It doesn't go against our, you know, when we go out to get a bond, they're not, it doesn't go against the volume of stuff we have. So it doesn't really.
They don't have to add it to their CAM fees so that when they show prospective tenants, they can show a lower CAM fee.
That's right.
There's other advantages to it.
Yeah, they
also, if we do a PID versus them doing other tools, they don't have to leverage it with their property standing behind it. If we allow them to do it.
Yeah, there's another mechanism that they can do their own board.
Yeah, but we're not part of that board. Once you say they can do it, then it's all them.
It's their board. They have, and you approve the rules under which they, so that when they operate, but they operate independently.
From a unique enhancement side, and this goes back to the history of it, it was all sold on this idea that they would access public markets through allowance by a city council. And so at the time, the way the cities were sold, different than what just the plain place that the statute says, is we could all do it for unique enhancements. And the majority of cities have a very similar policy that Randy Larson, who talked about the draft or talked about legislation, explained that he's a bond attorney for most cities, that he drafted both the statute in large part and also the policy most cities adopt, which has this unique enhancement language, I think in section 5, if I remember right. We looked at it the other day.
It's throughout,
yeah.
but there's definitions.
That section, when you look at a commercial development, you know, what is the unique enhancement they can bring? Well, compared to residential, one thing that's unique is we get all the property tax rather than the, was it 65% that we get 55. In residential? 55? I always get that number wrong. I cannot remember for life of me.
65 would be better than 55.
Yeah, that would be. But with commercial, we get it all. Plus, with commercial, we get sales tax. So by allowing this option, if you want to think of it in terms of, well, what do we get out of it? One, we're dealing with sophisticated entities who expect things like this rather than homeowners that are mystified why they're paying for similar houses, different rates of taxes, right? And two, because the sophisticated people know what they're buying. Two, we get all the sales tax and we get all the property tax, which we don't get on residential. And so it is unique when you compare the two. And that's one argument I would propose for bifurcating or splitting the process between the two.
Yeah, like Mr. Lewis said, I mean, even if it's not just lease, if it's a purchase, if they parcel it off and purchase it, they're going to go through pro formas, they're going to go through the whole process, they're going to see this, and they're going to go, it's actually going to lower the property value a little bit, because you know, it's an encumbrance against the property, and when they run their numbers to make a pencil, they've got to do that. And so,
and the previous council did this with the, as Mr. Bree said, with the SAA that we did for Daybreak, and so they could put in water and road infrastructure and build an accelerated place. The SAA, they did have to leverage their process. It's a different tool, but it gave them access to the bond market and everything. But in there, and I think Sunil and Gary were part of this, of saying, listen, we don't want this to affect residential. So residential, that assessment is paid off in full at building permit. Whereas, is it building permit? Yeah, it's building permit. Whereas with
commercial,
it just keeps running and they pay as they go until the SAA is paid off, till the bonds are done, which is, I think that's a 20 or 30 year bond period.
And they have commercials, they have an option to pay off.
Yeah, they can pay it off. But how long is that bond period on there, that one?
Almost
30, and these pits can go.
This has our policy has a 30-year maximum.
So they'd be obligated. To 30 years.
And they can't use it for operations and maintenance. It has to be used for public improvements. Yeah. And anyway,
and it's public infrastructure district. So whether it's private or public infrastructure,
yeah,
because it does give some private.
And that's part
stuff.
Of what
it has
I've
to be
at.
Things like it has to be things like water, sewer. Yeah. Roads, lights, it's infrastructure.
Even if it stays
they can't
private.
Use it to build the actual vertical buildings. Right. They have to use it to build the infrastructure.
And it has to be for the public good. Mm-hmm. Under this, they could hold it privately or they could dedicate it. It says they have to build it to the standards of our standards and whatnot.
Do you mind if we have some council discussion? Is that okay? Are you guys done?
No, I'm just finishing up. So
okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So one thing I was just wondering is, you know, and this is just, it's not a question, it's more just a comment. It's just, what's this going to drive in? I mean, these are going to be sophisticated developers that come in. So I'm wondering how many of these are going to be Utah developers that utilize this versus, you know, capital venture groups that come in to, you know, see what they can do to, you know, say, hey, this is being allowed, you know, in certain areas. And Utah's a state where there's a lot of growth and there's opportunities and they're really just trying to maximize their dollars. You know, it'll be interesting to see what we see in Utah from this. Yeah.
I will tell you that Pitts have been a little slow to get off the ground. I know Harriman approved 3 and it took some time before they got purchased. They've made some progress.
7 or 8, but they've only been able to fund.
Maybe that's what it is. They've only funded 3. Yeah.
In the Olympia.
Well, and I can tell
so
you that.
So they've gone to the bond market and haven't been able to.
Yeah, it took some time to get
they
those.
Can't find
so,
buyers.
Yeah, it's taken some time, like a lot of time.
Interesting.
I can tell you that this is the tool that the state of Utah is using to put all the infrastructure in phase 1 of the point. Is PIDS.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's specific language in the statute for them for you know, and then municipalities. So it's something that's available to all of us.
So we had a robust discussion a few years back about that we did not like this in residential areas for all the reasons that you just said, right? We don't want, if I live on this side of the street and you live on that side of the street, and one of us is paying more than the other for same houses that look the same, like, you know. I'd be surprised if this body's changed their mind on that, but we, if so, you know, feel free to chime in. But as a tool where we have so few tools for economic development, and we're not bound by this at all, it's just something we can use should it be the right tool in a certain zone or place or certain project or not. There's still things about PIDs that I just don't really love. There just are, and that's, I'm not probably going to change my mind on that. However, as a tool, I can see it at least being added to our very limited toolbox as something else that we can consider on a per project basis, depending on what it is, why it is, and if it works or if it doesn't in an economic development project to help get infrastructure in. Because I think we all realize there's just not many infrastructure dollars, and there's not many, that's a high priority for the state this year, but there's not. And it's the infrastructure that holds up the development. And since this isn't for housing, since this is specific for economic development, and we're looking for those opportunities, For that reason, I can kind of plug my nose a little bit, and be supportive of adding this tool to our toolbox as something we can at least consider.
It's in the box. You don't necessarily have to use it.
Yeah.
But if the right project comes along where it's the right tool,
right,
it'd be good to have it in the box. Right.
And it's like I've always said about the
case
that
we
tax.
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. And process. So what do we need to do tonight? Do we need to say
tell
yes?
Us you want us to draft the language. We'll change the policy. We'll bring a resolution, and you can adopt the resolution.
This is kind of allowing it to be used slightly broader for economic development when there's really not much more we can do.
We don't
to
have
help
a lot of tools in that toolbox.
Create
this
an incentive for economic development.
This isn't approving anything. It's
no.
Saying, yes,
not
let's make this a tool.
It's
we
adjusting
can
the policy
case
so that we can split that for a PID between residential and commercial. We have certain rules for residential. We have certain rules for commercial. Mm-hmm. Right now, it's all or nothing. We're saying, give us the chance to break that out. So when we talk to commercial people and it's purely commercial, we've got a special tool we can use.
And process-wise, either way, it goes to a committee, and that includes Sunil and Nessa and everybody, and we give you a recommendation based on did they meet all the requirements
like
in the list. There's
nine or ten requirements they have to meet. The DAC reviews that. We come back, we give you a recommendation. Then you guys decide, yes, go forward and create your governing documents, or you know what, we're just not going to do that. The answer is no.
And to play the devil's advocate against just what I even just said, there are projects where, but for some kind of tool like this, the developer doesn't have the finances to be able to put in the infrastructure. Nobody has the money to put in the infrastructure, and this tool might be the only way.
Well, and I'll tell you one thing I've seen is in a public meeting, a sewer board meeting, you know, and this, I think this was in Harriman actually, but where, you know, they're trying to figure out, okay, you know, what is, you know, when you're seeing a reimbursement for these developers, like, okay, is it just for the project, or is it really for bigger, you know, public benefit, you know, and if it's bigger public benefit, you can get reimbursements. And so that's part of, you know, what Suber does is sometimes evaluate those types of things. And as they're doing this whole thing is not everything has to go PID. They could do part of it in a PID, some of the outside the PID. So they're going, it's like, okay, can we get reimbursement for that? No. Well, maybe, okay, then maybe we'll do a PID on it versus reimbursement. And then everything, and then impact fees come into play. It's like, if you do this, you know, there's a whole lot of things that all kind of play together here on how these things work, you know, when they're talking about utilities, between reimbursements, impact fees, and all that in PIDs. And so it was very interesting to be there in that and see how all that worked. And really what it seemed like it gave that developer additional levers to pull to be able to get the project that they need, that were because of certain rules or guidelines or procedures, they might not have been able to do it otherwise. And so I do see some of the benefits, you know, that's there, just opens the door for them in other ways.
Yeah. It's like when we look at projects and sometimes we go after, yeah, we use some general funds, we use some impact fees, we get some federal funds, we try, yeah, to get some state funds. That's how you make a project happen. In that same light, developers have to look at, can I get some PID funds? Can I do this? Can I do this? And
yeah,
that's how they get these projects done.
Yeah.
It's just one more tool.
Yeah.
And we have full discretion as to when it gets used.
Yeah.
Kind of, and just in summary, I mean, it's just, it's like our other tools that we used to have. And we still have those tools. They're just, but they're for office buildings and stuff. We can't use them on retail. But I've always said, even those types of tools, they're tools. You got to be careful with them, just like your skill saw. You can build a house with it or you can cut your arm off with it. And you just got to be careful. And we didn't always give everybody that wanted our other, you know, we were very careful and made sure that they met the butt for. And it was something that we wanted. You know, if they want to propose something that we're not happy with, we don't have to use it. So anyway, if you're comfortable with us moving forward, we'll bring you back I guess it's a resolution to adopt a new a revised policy.
Well, splitting the two so that it opens a path for the arm that this council might be amenable to, I think is a wise idea.
Things are so expensive right now. I mean, it's hard sometimes for people to fund all this infrastructure, you know, up front. And so I think it comes into play more now than probably what it did in the past.
Sounds like we have a marching march.
Yeah. Okay. We'll have that revised and brought back.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thanks. All right. I am going to ask for a motion to recess our city council study meeting and move us into executive closed session to discuss the character, professional competence, physical or mental health of an individual. Can I get a motion?
So moved.
Thank you. Can I get a second?
Second.
Thank you. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Thank you.